This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, some states are requiring new automobiles to meet California air pollution standards, which are tougher than federal requirements. Technology and cleaner gas may cut smog, unless car population increases wipe out the gains. Atlanta, the sprawl capital of the USA, struggles to craft a transportation strategy in a stinky city for air quality, which is choking on cars. Go to the movies and get an environmental message? The Union of Concerned Scientists will be feeding it to you whether or not you buy the popcorn. And on the Earth calendar, brown trout in Idaho have just completed their spawning season. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Actions by some states are causing auto manufacturers to build cleaner cars than the federal government requires. Governor Pataki of New York has announced that beginning with the model year 2004, cars sold in the state will be required to meet the California emission standards. These are more strict than the federal standards imposed by the Federal Clean Air Act. Hearings have just been held in Massachusetts, where a similar requirement is under consideration. These actions in New York and Massachusetts could have national significance because, together with California, they account for 25% of all auto sales within the United States. John Cahill, New York State's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, explains.
The Federal Clean Air Act requires basically two vehicles to be sold in the country. One is the national car, which is known as Tier 2, and California, because of air quality problems, has been given the ability to require the production of their own vehicles, and that's known as LEV 2. And states are allowed by the Clean Air Act to opt in to California LEV 2, which is a much more stringent program. So what that means is that they will have tighter control emissions, both on NOx and really the whole series of pollutants that are emitted by auto vehicles. And so we, New York State, will see real air quality benefits out to 2010 because of the stricter emission requirements on the California LEV 2 cars.
Peter Ionowitz, Director of Environmental Health for the American Lung Association of New York, says cleaning up exhaust from auto tailpipes will improve human health.
Because vehicles are, you know, about half the problem of smog in the summertime and contribute to other sources of airborne toxics and pollutants year-round. So the cleaner the vehicle fleet, the better we all breathe.
Gloria Berquist, who is the spokesperson for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, a trade organization which represents 11 car companies that produce 90% of U.S. sales, says the New York decision does not necessarily produce cleaner air.
New York adopting California's program can be a positive and it can be a negative toward achieving cleaner cars. And here's how. If New York adopts California's program for the car and the fuel, there will be cleaner air. And why I stress the fuel is because that will have immediate benefits on all the cars on the road today, not just cars that are being made in the future. But if New York chooses to only pick some of the items that are in California's program, it could actually have a negative effect. And the reason why is that sulfur contaminates the catalytic converter. That's the emissions control equipment that's made the tremendous reductions in nitrogen oxides and other constituents in California. And so if the catalytic converter was neutralized by dirty fuel, then you're going to be having reduced benefits or no benefits.
Currently, the United States Environmental Protection Agency has started the administrative process to lower the sulfur standards in gas and diesel fuels. This is a move that's being backed by the auto manufacturers and opposed by the oil companies. Auto manufacturer spokesperson Berquist emphasizes how important it is to lower the amount of sulfur permitted in gasoline.
Automakers are very concerned that states like New York and Massachusetts are adopting California's clean cars, but not California's clean fuels. Both the California program and the rule that EPA is working on now include both clean cars and low sulfur fuel, which is a cleaner fuel. And here's why that's so important. As an analogy, you wouldn't take a shower and put on dirty clothes, So why would you have a clean car and then use high sulfur fuel? Sulfur is the lead of the 90s, and we need to get low sulfur fuel in order to have cleaner air.
A number of countries, like Germany and Japan, have set gasoline sulfur content below the levels required by California. New York Commissioner Cahill is confident the EPA will soon require low sulfur fuel everywhere in the United States.
They came out with draft regulations earlier this year. We've been given every indication by the EPA that they will get those low sulfur fuel requirements out by the end of this year. So they will be. We fully anticipate to have low sulfur fuel here in New York ready for the 2004 model year.
The auto manufacturers say the California exhaust standard adds $100 to $200 more to the vehicle's sticker price. This leads driver advocacy groups like the National Motorists Association to oppose the action of New York and other states that want to require cleaner cars. The manufacturers say this is not an issue, since they have found consumers are willing to bear the cost for a better environment. While the adoption of California emission requirements by New York and Massachusetts may push the manufacturers to build all cars to the higher California standard, Honda and Nissan are going one better. Special models of the Nissan Sentra and the Honda Accord have just come out, which have no emissions at all. Unlike other zero-emission vehicles which run on electric motors, these vehicles have four-cylinder gas engines and super-efficient catalytic converters. The net result is that the combination of new technology and some pushing by big states means that in the future, there will be less air pollution per car than there is today. The unanswered question is whether the actual number of cars sold each year will continue to increase, so the total tons of pollution being released to our air and our lungs remains the same. Last week, we told you about how much Atlanta, Georgia has grown over the last several years. The area is now home to more than 3 million people. But of the 3 million people in the metro region, only 14% actually live in the city of Atlanta. The counties on the outer boundaries of the city have seen the largest population increases during the last decade. The growth has helped make the city and the region's economy strong, but it's taken its toll on the environment. In the second of a two-part series, Mark Brody reports on how Atlanta is responding to the growth and the environmental degradation that has come with it.
Well, I'm gonna move, baby. Way on the outskirts of town.
That seems to be a popular sentiment in the Atlanta region, where people have flocked to the suburbs, leaving a trail of roads, highways, and newly cleared land in their wake. Walt Higgins, the Vice Chair of Environmental Affairs for the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce and Chair and CEO of a major Atlanta utility, says the growth can be understood in terms of a cycle. People come to the area, which brings companies, which helps fuel the region's economy.
Atlanta is enjoying the benefits not of 1 year's work or three promotional programs, but many, many years of a pro-business, pro-economic development, pro-let's-do-the-right-thing so that there can be a great quality of life here. The challenge, of course, is to do all that and at the same time not stress the system.
Some argue those challenges are not being met. Brian Hager of the Georgia chapter of the Sierra Club says traffic congestion has contributed to the city's air pollution problem, a problem, he says, which results from public policy. Hager, who is the director of the Sierra Club's Georgia Challenge to Sprawl campaign, says Atlanta needs to change its development and transportation patterns.
We created this kind of sprawling development pattern over 50 years between mostly government actions, whether it's the highway programs that we've been building, the very aggressive construction of highways throughout those suburban areas that makes cheap land available for development. And then we've had grant programs to build new sewer systems and things like that that, again, are subsidizing sprawl.
Hager says his organization is trying to eliminate these subsidies by encouraging local governments to enforce environmental laws already on the books. He says many of these attempts have been successful because governments see growth doesn't necessarily pay for itself. Recognizing the need for new approaches to transportation, in March of this year, Georgia Governor Roy Barnes and the state legislature approved the Georgia Regional Transportation Authority, or GRTA. This agency has the power to dictate transportation plans to local governments. The authority's executive director, Dr. Catherine Ross, likens Atlanta's situation to a freeway.
You put cars on it and it operates fairly efficiently as long as there aren't too many cars. And then at some point in time, you have too many cars going to the same place at the same point in time, and virtually nothing moves. If you take that analogy and apply it to land and the ability of land to sustain various kinds of activities, we know that at some point in time, we can consume so much of that that we limit our ability to be productive.
Ross says the agency is still in the preliminary phase of its planning, but says it's crucial to provide alternatives to driving. Those could include buses, trains, bike paths, pedestrian pathways, or other modes of transportation. In addition to the traffic congestion, the Metro Atlanta region is also losing its tree canopy, which is making the city hotter. Warm weather is nothing new to the residents of Hot Atlanta, but Lucy Griggs, regional director of Cool Communities in Georgia, says with all the other problems, heat can easily be overlooked.
Many people think you can't really do anything about the sunlight. Well, in a way you can. There's some of these strategies that we're promoting that would actually help reduce this heat island phenomenon.
Those strategies include using lighter colored surfaces on large horizontal roofs and parking lots, which would reflect sunlight instead of absorbing it. In addition, Greg says Cool Communities is promoting more urban shade trees, which would help control erosion as well as provide a break from the sun. These efforts are not going unnoticed. Dan Reuter, Division Chief for Land Use Planning at the Atlanta Regional Commission, says many counties are trying to maintain their trees and use different surfaces on parking lots and rooftops. Reuter acknowledges many organizations can help solve the sprawl problem and says the Atlanta Regional Commission, the metro area's official planning agency, has some ideas of its own.
Just recently, the transportation section of our ARC has unveiled a new transportation plan, and over the next 25 years, a majority of the funds here in Atlanta will actually go to transit more so than highways, and that's a big change from what has been the past in the Atlanta region.
Some environmentalists are concerned governments won't take the necessary environmental steps because Atlanta's booming economy owes much of its success to the region's growth. Atlanta is currently home to 11 Fortune 500 companies. That's tied for fourth place with St. Louis in terms of number of Fortune 500 companies, behind only Houston, Chicago, and New York City. The Sierra Club's Brian Hager says if things don't get better, they'll get much worse.
If the local governments do not, and the Georgia Regional Transportation Authority cannot, come together and agree on solutions, the quality of life is going to continue to decline in this region. Our reputation as a stinky city for air quality is just going to get worse. Other places are going to clean up. We're not. And we're going to see fewer people moving here. The economy is going to decline. And the businesses that saw Atlanta as a hot growth market are going to start leaving.
Some environmentalists are hopeful. Since Georgia was hit with the clean air restrictions before many other places, it might start dealing with the problem sooner. Until it does, the state will be unable to use federal money to build more roads. While it's unclear as to what's going to be done to help control Atlanta's sprawl, experts say it's clear this southbound trend is likely to continue well into the future. Reporting for The Environment Show, I'm Mark Brody.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. If you have thoughts about urban sprawl, get in touch with us. Email green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Regular mail is Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. It has an environmental theme, and it's coming to a movie theater near you. It's not a movie, but it has a plot that is more serious than most science fiction films and may reach millions of people around the world. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott explains.
You as a moviegoer in the United States or Canada will soon be seeing movie trailers of a different kind. They're public service announcements narrated by various celebrities designed to inform folks about the causes and effects of global warming. Actor Patrick Stewart, probably best known for his role as the captain in the Star Trek series, is among those doing voiceovers.
It's the only planet known to sustain life. The only one whose atmosphere has been regulated by nature to create the perfect balance. But today the Earth is warming, and nature's not doing it. Fortunately, all of us know someone who has the power to do something.
Viewers of this PSA are bombarded by dramatic pictures of bees, frogs, and deserts. It shows a large section of an iceberg falling into the sea to illustrate the problems associated with climate change. The movie trailers are part of a campaign called A Perfect Balance, initiated by the environmental group Union of Concerned Scientists with the help of the Earth Communications Office, or ECO, located in Hollywood. Alden Meyer is Director of Government Relations for UCS.
Well, it's a good way to reach people when they're sitting there watching and thinking about entertainment, and it grabs their attention. It's obviously done in a very striking visual way.
Meyer says each PSA delivers several important messages to moviegoers.
It makes the point that the Earth has been in a miraculous balance to support life over thousands of years, that human activities are starting to disrupt that balance, but I think the hopeful message is there are things we can do about it if we start now, and it sort of leaves people with the sense that if we as human beings take action, we can avert the worst part of this problem. But it's clearly designed to let people know that this is a serious problem that will have tremendous impacts both on human communities and ecosystems.
Meyer says the challenging part of such a campaign is to inform people without overwhelming them. He says if people feel as though there is nothing they can do about global warming, they will be too overwhelmed and become paralyzed.
So one of the things we try to do in this campaign and in our work on issues like renewable energy and advanced transportation technology is to let people know that there are things they can do in their own lives that make a difference, and there are things that both business and government in the United States can do that would make a tremendous difference in solving this problem. You have to give people concrete hope that there are steps we can take to deal with the threat of global warming, or as I said, they feel paralyzed into inaction.
The movie trailers are playing now, primarily on the West Coast. But by January, UCS expects the campaign to be in full swing, reaching about 7,000 movie theaters across the United States and Canada. The public service announcements will run through Earth Day 2000 in about 15 countries. Alden Meyer believes educating millions of people around the globe is important because climate change is a problem that is global in proportion. For more information about the campaign, go to www.oneearth.org. That's www.oneearth.org. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
It took billions of years, but it was perfect. New life coming from the old, part of it hot, part of it frozen. A constantly moving blend of atmospheric elements kept the thermostat perfect. to support the delicate balance. It has been called a miracle. And when you see how perfectly everything works together, you realize that it is. But today, the earth is warming. If it continues, what quenched our thirst will flood the land. What filled our plates will turn to dust. Nature is not doing this. We are. Nature cannot stop it. We can. But we have to start. Now.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. In certain rivers and streams of Idaho, brown trout have just completed another spawning season. Many of them were raised at the Mackey Fish Hatchery, located in the central part of the state, near the Pioneer Mountains. Manager Phil Kuntz says female brown trout produce certain hormones which tell males they're ready to mate.
And then they'll set up territories and fight off other males from entering, and then the females will come in. They need a gravelly stream to spawn in, usually stream spawners, and they'll dig a nest or red and lay some or all of their eggs in, and a male will come alongside and fertilize, and then she'll cover it up and go dig another nest, and they don't die after spawning, unlike a salmon.
Phil says females are not monogamous and may mate with another male in the same season. The 1,000 or more eggs deposited by the female will incubate in the gravel-covered river bottom all winter. The young eventually appear in the spring.
Emerging from the gravel, they are called fry, swim-up fry, and they'll stay out of the fast waters and stay to the sides of the smaller creeks, whatever, because if they get out in the main flow, they're swept away, and plus they're more exposed to predators.
The young brown trout will continue to feed and grow, and will reach sexual maturity several years later. They're carnivorous fish that prey on insects, crayfish, salamanders, and other animals. Fully grown, brown trout are about 18 to 20 inches in length and weigh around 4 pounds, although some have been found to weigh more than 30. Phil describes what adults look like.
Brown trout usually have a brownish to olive back, and they have large black spots down their back. The sides of the fish are usually light brown to yellowish, and they'll have brown, black, and red spots down their sides. And around those spots, they'll have a blue halo. Each spot will have a bluish to gray halo around it, too. And their fins will usually have an orangish tip on them. Leading edge will be kind of orangish, while other fish usually have white tips on their fins.
Phil Kuntz says some brown trout live 10 or more years, which is longer than some other fish species. Idaho Fish and Game recently decided to stop hatching fish that were not native to Idaho, which means no more brown trout will be raised at the Mackey Fish Hatchery. But when the facility did raise them, Phil would receive shipments of very young brown trout, known as fingerlings, from Wyoming and Virginia around the end of the year. The trout would be fed and cared for until they were about 2.5 pounds and then released in May. Unfortunately, Phil says many fish were often introduced to polluted waterways.
The waters we do stock the brown trout here in Idaho, like I say, are not your pristine waters at all. One creek that we plant in, Marsh Creek, is a degraded stream just due to agricultural runoff. The sedimentation load is heavy. The Rock Creek out of Twin Falls is a degraded stream due to also agricultural runoff.
Brown trout were introduced to the United States in the 1880s from Europe. They're a favorite sport fish for anglers, and as a fly fisherman, I've always found them a lot harder to catch than brook trout or rainbows. They're also known as English brown trout, European brown trout, German trout, and brownies. So before you throw one back, listen closely. If you hear a distinct European accent, you'll know you've got the real thing. Or maybe it will tell you a story that's a little fishy. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead. In our continuing series on genetic modification, we turn to the grocery store shelf. If a food you buy contains genetically modified crops, should the law require that fact to be disclosed on the label? The grocery manufacturers say no. The Consumers Union says yes. Both predict bad things if their view is not adopted, and there seems to be no room for compromise. Inside national parks, there are some tracts of private land that are owned by folks who got there before the park was established. The U.S. Park Service wants to buy them out to prevent development of the park, but some don't want to go. The conflict is between public and private interests. We hear both sides. Stay with us. We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Many people say that our environment is defined by what we eat. So today, we're going to be talking about food, genetically modified crops, and whether foodstuffs that contain genetically modified crops should bear labels that say so. And the matter is the subject of huge controversy. By and large, American agriculture and food processors have resisted the idea that labeling everything that is genetically modified is required. And you'll recall that a genetically modified organism is a plant or animal that has had a gene inserted in it, usually a gene from a different kind of living thing. And this can produce a crop that's resistant to certain pests, or one that can survive frost, such as the case of strawberries. Corn and soybeans have been genetically modified to enable them to be used with certain weed killers, such as Roundup. And so again, should the food processor be required to say on the label of the food product that a content of the product is genetically modified? My guests are Gene Grabowski. He is Vice President of Communications for the Grocery Manufacturers of America Association, and his organization represents the interests of food processors. He's located in Washington. Also with us is Mike Hansen. He's Research Associate with the Consumer Policy Institute. That's part of Consumers Union, which publishes consumer reports, and he's in New York State. Gene Grabowski, let's start with you. Why shouldn't every food label say whether or not the content has a genetically modified product inside?
Well, first, thanks for allowing me to participate in this discussion. I think that it's important that we have a reasoned debate about biotech in this country. But to get right to it, labels in this country, in the United States, go on foods, or any product for that matter, when they're there to demonstrate to the public, to consumers, that there's a reason to have something labeled. What I mean is, if you label something, it has to have meaning. We don't label, for example, when food products are made with recycled water. We don't label for things that are not relevant. The FDA decided in 1992 that unless foods produced through biotechnology are substantially different from regular foods, then they shouldn't bear a special label. So foods derived from biotechnology are labeled where it's appropriate. For example, if there's a chance that any of these foods derived from biotechnology might create an allergy or there's a substantial difference, then they would have a label. But where there's no difference, where there's no reason to label, there's no point in putting it on a food derived from biotechnology, because that would be misleading and would create a concern about a food that probably shouldn't be there.
Okay, and Mike Hansen from Consumers Policy Institute, I gather you see this somewhat differently.
Yes, we believe that actually all foods that contain genetically engineered or genetically modified in the European sense of the word ingredients indeed should be labeled. And the point of fact, the law, we think the law in fact mandates this. These are what are called material facts, and indeed these things, other things do get labeled that are of importance to consumers. For example, you have to put on a label if you put a protein hydroxylate on there. You have to say what the source of that protein hydroxylate is. That is, whether it comes from a plant or animal, because that is, of course, of importance to folks that are vegetarians or to kosher Jews and halal Muslims who might want to avoid something that contains material from a pig for religious reasons.
But how do you deal with Gene's point that if this stuff has no impact on the health impact of the product itself, it simply isn't any more relevant than putting the kind of water that you use?
In a certain sense, if it's important to people, then it is material in the legal sense of the term, because why should whether, if you have, for example, a protein hydroxylate which comes from a pig, that doesn't have any health impact either, but a kosher Jew and a halal Muslim and a vegetarian, that's important information for them for religious and ethical reasons.
Boy,
and we require that to be labeled, and I would just say it seems to me that the biotech industry is being fundamentally hypocritical, because on one hand they say these foods are really no different, so there's no reason to label them, but yet they walk over to the patent office and say this is such a new, radical, unique technology that we need a new form of intellectual property rights, utility patents on these things because they're so new and different.
Okay, well, let's hold off on the patent issue for a moment. Gene, what about the fact that somebody says, well, I just like to know, I might have maybe not a religious persuasion, but feel very strongly that this is stuff that I don't want to eat, and so I ought to be able to know what's in it before I buy the product?
I think that's an excellent point. First, I just want to reassure all the listeners that while technology is available to put animal genes into plants, it's not being done, nor are there any plans to do so. This is a red herring that's, pardon the pun, that's being put out there. In fact, more than 90% of the genes that are in plants are also in animals. So when we want to go get a gene that prevents plants from freezing the field or has them ripen more naturally, we can get that from plants. So knowing that people are concerned, especially for dietary reasons, mixing plants and animal genes in the food, there are no plans to do so.
Aside from plants and animals, suppose somebody just wants to know because they happen to feel strongly about that issue, plant to plant. Why shouldn't they know?
Well, the concern is this. The FDA is a government agency that has the trust of the public. There's nothing like it in the world. That's one of the reasons we had the hysteria over biotech foods in Europe. But the FDA is there to protect health and make decisions based on sound science. It's not supposed to put these issues up to a popular vote. If you wanted to know whether recycled water was used in a product, or if I wanted to know whether what color of the grapes that went into a product were, or any number of things, there's no way to stop it. The FDA is there to protect health, not to put these labeling issues up to a vote and create hysteria over foods. The people who oppose biotech foods want to put a label on it because they know it will create concerns where there is no reason for it, and the FDA says so. By putting the label on, they scare people away from biotech foods.
Okay, let's hear from Mike on that. Is that why you think this stuff ought to be labeled, to scare people away from the food?
We think it should be labeled because consumers have a basic right to know what they're eating, and in a certain sense, some have argued that this is just like an additive, and just like all additives and ingredients have to be listed on labels, I don't think that necessarily frightens people if they read labels and see that there's all these additives and ingredients in there. That is required by law. In fact, there is a lawsuit right now against the Food and Drug Administration by a large coalition, by a number of groups, saying that the Food and Drug Administration has not followed the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and has not required for example, mandatory safety testing for all these foods. And what's interesting is since that lawsuit was filed, 40,000 pages during the discovery process, 40,000 pages of documents came out, and among those documents, it turns out that top scientists within the Food and Drug Administration were disagreeing with the FDA's policy not to treat genetic engineering any differently than conventional breeding. So it's interesting that some of their own top scientists said that that genetic engineering does raise different and significant potential health considerations, and therefore they should be treated like new food additives, that is, with mandatory safety testing and mandatory labeling.
Well, let me just respond by saying that every food product on a grocery store shelf must meet the U.S. law's requirements for safety and labeling, regardless of what the origin is. Federal regulation has never required that food labels describe the plant development processes by which the food's produced. So such processes aren't material information that must be labeled. Because the law is aimed at ensuring safe food and informative labels, biotech products shouldn't be singled out. These are fringe groups that are trying to single out foods and create an alarm and create a hysteria so that they can raise money through for their own purposes, for their groups, so that they have an issue to play with. This is
Gene, let me ask you.
That tells you that Chinese food is bad for you and Mexican.
Well, let me interrupt you for a moment, though, and ask you, this has got a somewhat different dimension in Europe, where my understanding is there are much stricter labeling requirements, and whether or not that was fringe groups in action, how does the U.S. food industry react to European requirements, particularly if one wants to sell American food products in Europe?
Food companies have to adhere to the different cultural and legal rules in different countries and different cultures. But there was a survey that came out just 2 days ago, everybody has seen it, that shows that among consumers in Europe, out of 9 issues like nutrition and fat content and sugars in food, biotech was number 9. What happened in Europe was an aberration. We had the consumers were stampeded. More importantly, the governments were stampeded into action before the consumers had all the information, and we won't allow that to happen here. We want a reasonable debate. The kinds of people who want to stop biotech and want a label are the people who are uprooting crops, who are talking about going to supermarkets and vandalizing by putting stickers on. These are the kind of desperate tactics of people who want to stop a technology that is going to be providing us with great food opportunities here and opportunities to feed the world that is starving, that needs this kind of plant technology. And if you want to know who is for biotech, ask third world countries. Ask the Vatican.
The notion is that this is simply an effort to monkey wrench the whole process. Do you see it that way?
No, I don't. And I think it's, you know, doing this name calling. If there are supposed fringe groups that are opposing this technology, excuse me, the British Medical Association, which represents 85% of all the medical doctors in the United Kingdom, we're talking about about 115,000 doctors in the United Kingdom, they put out a report in May that very clearly said there has been inadequate safety testing for these crops. They called on the
That report has been laughed at and discredited. Plus, you want to talk about an organization that's ripped in half. There's one.
That's the British Medical Association.
That organization is completely divided over the issue, and you know it. It's a fraud.
Okay, let me ask you both something. If the organization or any organization is divided, and let's presume that not everybody who is on one side or the other is a kook, and if our society is based on some notion of full disclosure, and particularly if most of the folk in Europe weren't affected by this, why not tell the consumer so they know what they're getting?
I agree with that. That's, in fact, why in the United Kingdom you see all these companies, because what the market wants, what the consumers and retailers want, is they want to know.
Well, Gene, let's hear from the manufacturers on this, because this obviously is of great concern to you guys. Is the lack of disclosure, whether it is relevant or not, something that you feel can really hurt the American food industry?
What will hurt the food industry, what will hurt consumers, is if you label unnecessarily and create a hysteria where there is none.
Well, but let me just ask you to focus on that for a moment, and that is, if your European experience has been that people really don't care, is it really sound to say that by putting it on the label there will be hysteria any more than
there's chaos
all the
right
other
now.
Stuff
there
that's
was,
out there?
There was a front-page story in the Wall Street Journal 2 years ago, I mean 2 weeks ago, excuse me, that points out what chaos they have in Britain because they put in this rule about non-biotech and nobody has a way to measure it. Nobody knows what non-biotech is. The same products are going on shelves in different stores, and it's a fraud. Nobody knows what's behind the label because they can't even test for it. What happened was the government fiat was dictated before there was any way in place to even measure what the threshold is of allowances for biotech foods. Because, as a matter of fact, they're not even calling for GMO-free. They're allowing a 1% threshold. So you can have a 1% GM biotech ingredient in the product, and it doesn't get labeled. So,
so our listeners understand this, GMO stands for genetically modified organisms. Now,
right.
Mike,
or biotech foods.
Mike, if there is a question about how you can determine what is or what isn't, how do you resolve that one? Would you put a label on? Is there anything that you would not label?
I think we're for putting labels on all foods. You can often detect either the DNA or the protein, and for those foods where you can't, there's ways to have a paper trail, just like, for example, with organic foods, which get labeled as being organic. There's no simple test you can do, so you have a paper trail. On the labeling issue, I will just say that surveys have been done in the United States, and they consistently show 80 to 93, 94% of the people want mandatory labeling. And I would think, you know, the grocery manufacturers of America, they should do a survey. And I bet you if they do a survey, they'll find out that over 90% of the people favor a requirement by law to label all genetically modified foods. And I would bet that the majority of those folks would feel very strongly about that.
Gene, do you feel that
after survey shows that people want labeling of genetically engineered foods?
Gene, do you feel that labeling would actually hurt the sale of products?
Well, we have done surveys, by the way, and there are other public surveys that have been mentioned. And the surveys do show that people want, they show a couple of things. First of all, they show that knowledge about biotech foods is actually very low. And it shows that people do want more information about biotech foods. And they're not particularly picky about where they get it. They'll take it from 800 numbers. They'll take it from websites. They'll take it from news articles. They'll take it from shows such as this so that people can make up their minds. What we don't want to have happen is what we had happen in Europe, where people got railroaded into this idea, this hysteria that you needed to have labeling for no good reason. And the reason is, people, in a knee-jerk reaction, said, yes, give me labels, label it for me, because I'm scared. And what I would say is if people have more understanding and more knowledge about biotech foods and they still want to label it, then we'll consider it. But to go screaming and hollering around the country and doing protests for labeling when there's no proven reason for it is absurd. As a matter of fact, it creates more mischief and harm than if we had a reasoned debate, had people consider it for a few months, and then let's see if labeling's still a viable option.
Perhaps, Mike, you could react to this notion that people really need more understanding in order to be able to make informed choices here.
I think people have enough understanding. They should actually learn more, and I think if people learned that there is no requirement for mandatory safety testing, that the companies are on the honor system right now to voluntarily come forward to the Food and Drug Administration if they think there might be a problem, that I think people would be very concerned about that.
My guests have been Gene Grabowski. He is from the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Also with us has been Mike Hansen from the Consumer Policy Institute, which is part of the Consumers Union. We know that you have views, and so we'd like you to share them with us. Should food labels tell you if genetically modified crops are involved in the product? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can hear The Environment Show anytime over the Internet. Go to www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. You can also go to www.wamc.org. That's www.wamc.org. A new federal budget has just been passed. It contains substantial appropriations for the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which was established to purchase land for parks, recreation, to protect wildlife endangered species open space, and to preserve historic buildings. About $900 million a year has flowed into the fund for royalties on offshore gas and oil drilling. But the Congress has made a practice of appropriating only a small amount of that. The rest has been spent for other purposes. With more money appropriated this year, the National Park Service will have the wherewithal to buy parcels of land known as inholdings. They're privately owned but are within our national parks. The purchase of inholdings has been debated for some time. Environmentalists say parks can be better protected if the federal government buys out the inholders, while the property rights and conservative folks say the government does not do an effective job in managing our natural areas. The passions evoked by the inholdings issue is illustrated by a discussion I recently had with three people who have followed the topic for years. Dennis Galvin is Deputy Director of the National Park Service. Paul Pritchard is Executive Director of the National Park Trust, an organization dedicated to preserving America's parks. And Jerry Taylor is Director of Natural Resource Studies with the Cato Institute, a public policy organization with conservative and libertarian views. One of the issues that is highly controversial are the property rights and the future of people who own land inside parks, known as inholdings. Paul Pritchard, what should happen to those lands?
Well, those people who have lands which were included in a national park were under the impression, in practically every case, that at some point the federal government would sit down with them and negotiate a fair price to purchase those areas. Unfortunately, there isn't a lot of political excitement for members of Congress to carry out the dream of somebody else who created a park, and so we basically not carried out this vision of completing these areas. There's 6 million acres still left within the national park system. Some parks are totally owned by private individuals. What we need to do is to finish that, and that would come from a federal fund called the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which the Congress has not been funding.
Okay, Jerry, does it make sense to buy these people out and get them out of the parks?
Given the fact that most people were forcibly moved out of the parks in many of these acquisitions, the story of how the Appalachian parks were established is a fairly jaw-dropping tale of people forcibly removed from their homes and compensated very little for what their land was worth. And I think the reason why it's very difficult to convince Congress to continue this mopping up operation of removing people from their land is the simple fact that a lot of people who we think of as inholders don't want to move. They don't want to sell to the federal government, or they certainly aren't willing to accept the dollars that the federal government is offering because it's a submarket price. The government should just simply deal with the people who have, in fact, they bought that land, they built on it, it's theirs, and the federal government shouldn't treat them as interlopers. I mean, this country's based on the idea of private property, and there should be a bit more respect for people in this system than we're hearing in this inholder debate with the Park Service.
Okay, Dennis, what about it? Is the Park Service not giving these folk respect?
Yeah, just a point of clarification. We do not have the authority to buy anything that's not authorized by Congress. So Jerry's saying that Congress has got no stomach for this is just as inaccurate. We don't have authority to buy land generally like some other government agencies do. And as Paul also pointed out, in many instances, the people we buy from are given lifetime estates. They're given use and occupancy agreements of 25 or 30 years. The difficulty usually comes when those periods end and the people who struck a deal earlier on don't want to stick with it. In parks like Sleeping Bear Dunes and Apostle Islands, C&O Canal, and others, we have ongoing controversies that really relate to deals that were made 25 or 30 years ago. And
Dennis, from a practical standpoint, if they're just left there, and let's put aside a moment the legal obligations that may or may not exist to private deals, for a practical standpoint, does their presence have a negative impact on the park itself with respect to everybody else's use and enjoyment of the park?
The challenge, and this is Paul Pritchard, I would simply say that there's a lot of malarkey here about the Park Service or the federal government forcing all these people off their lands. I have letters on my desk at this moment from individuals who are saying, I want to sell my property, and I can't get any money because the Park Service can't get it from the Congress. The fact that people have historically wanted to sell that land and move on and do other things is, in fact, the truth. What we need to deal with is those 200,000 endangered acres, and these are properties that allow the individual to own the land in the middle of a very important natural or scenic or historic area, and then to build a road across the public's land and to put in utilities and other resources. If these individuals who want to sell can't get out of that situation, then they have every right to do that. That's really what we're talking about. We're not talking about forcibly moving anybody, and I think that's a bunch of malarkey.
Well, according to the National Inholders Association, other organizations, inholders, they certainly see it quite differently. After all, those very inholders are the ones who lobby against Congress giving any money to the Park Service to buy them out for two reasons. I mean, look, if they were all anxious to make a deal, believe me, they would support the appropriations process. But they don't for two reasons. One, they're afraid a lot of that money will be used to condemn their homes, and this will be a forcible condemnation where they have to accept the government's figure. Or two, they'll be bullied out or given a submarket rate. And then third, a lot of them just don't want to move out. Some of them do, some of them don't. The ones who don't want to move out are afraid the government will force them off that land through heck or high water, and the government has a history of doing that. And you can go to any local library and read about the creation of the parks in the eastern part of the United States and see story after story after story like that, Paul.
Okay, we recognize the stories. Dennis, at this point in time, what is the Park Service's approach to inholders when their leases have expired?
We want them to live up to the terms of the agreement we struck. And so if the use and occupancy has terminated, then we want the property for park purposes.
I want to thank you all. We've been discussing inholdings in our national park system with Jerry Taylor from the Cato Institute, Dennis Galvin from the National Park Service, and Paul Pritchard from the National Park Trust. Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Berlich. If you go to the movies to get the word on climate change, don't drive even a clean car if you live in Atlanta. Call 1-800-323-9262 and order show number 517. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.